Good morning. We're going to be reading this morning from Matthew chapter 27, verse 55 through chapter 28, verse 15. There were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Joseph and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered for it to be given to him, and Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise.' Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people, 'He has risen from the dead,' and that last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go, make it as secure as you can." So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day.
Well, in a scene from C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Susan and Lucy have just witnessed the impossible. Aslan, the great lion who was sacrificed on the stone table the night before, he's standing before them, and he's very much alive. And what they are experiencing in that moment is exactly what Lewis intended it to feel like, an echo of the first Easter morning. So, "Oh, Aslan," cries Lucy. And then both girls flung themselves on him and they covered him with kisses. "But what does it all mean?" asked Susan. "It means," said Aslan, "that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still that she did not know. If she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and darkness before time dawned, she would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards." So the witch, the villain in the story, had looked back to an ancient story, but she had not looked back to the deepest story. And as we look into today's text in Matthew, we're actually looking at the deepest story. We're looking at the story that transcends them all. We're looking at the story of stories, so to speak. And it's a story powerful enough to undo death itself. And when we look at that story, and when we live in that story, it brings transformation and healing to our own life stories. It's been said that the story you live in is the story that you end up living out. But in our life, there's all kinds of competing narratives. There's all kinds of inner scripts. Sometimes we're a little bit unaware of some of the inner scripts that we have that are controlling our life, the scripts that we are living in. And it's worth pausing to ask the question, what stories do I actually live in? What are the inner scripts that run my life? In Narnia, the witch, she looked to the wrong narrative. It ended up leading to her destruction, if you know the story. And to live from the wrong story is actually to short-circuit your own transformation. It's to accelerate your own disintegration. And so our text today, it's revealing both an invitation into the wonder of the story of stories, and it's also giving us a warning about the presence of lesser narratives that threaten to derail a life. So the main takeaway for us this morning as we look into this text in Matthew is make his story your story. And the his I'm talking about is Jesus. Make his story your story. This morning, we're going to look at this story of stories. We're going to see that in a nutshell, it's that Jesus really died and that Jesus really rose. And then we're also going to look at competing narratives, alternate stories. And as we look at both of these, we can learn how to locate our life story in his story so that we can experience the transformation and renewal and flourishing that comes when we live from the story of stories. Let's ask the Lord for his help, and then we will jump in. So Father God, we come to you, and we just ask for your help. Would you uncover hidden narratives in our life that maybe are not aligned with truth, not leading us towards flourishing? Would you help us to recognize the inner scripts that are controlling us? And would you help us to lean into your story and to locate our story as it relates to your story so that your story can transform ours, so that your story can redeem our broken stories, so that your story can be the controlling narrative of our lives. Help us to find life in this text this morning. Amen. So last week, we saw the suffering of Christ. We've been seeing that he was condemned, even though he was innocent. He was mocked, and the things that were true were thrown back in his face as though they were a joke. We've seen that he was crucified, beaten, whipped. We saw that he was forsaken. There was even a moment where there was a spiritual break between God the Father and Christ the man, and not between the Trinity, never broke up, but there was Christ really experienced what the damned experienced to a certain extent, a turning away of the face of God, a pain, a rejection. And so in this moment, there's some women who are present at the cross, and all of Jesus' followers, they're in this moment of confusion. Like, what's the true story? Like, is he the one? We thought he was the Messiah. Did we miss it? What were the Jewish leaders right? The ones who are convicting him and saying that he is a criminal? Like, what story is the true story? And that's where we're going to pick up the text. So we're going to look at the story of stories, and we're going to see first that Jesus really died. And we see this a number of ways. First, we see that his body was seen. So keep in mind, the last thing that just happened is Jesus just died on the cross. And the very next thing that comes is where our story picks up. There were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And these women are introduced because they are going to become the first key witnesses to the resurrection. And this would have been very surprising to Matthew's first readers. Actually, it itself is a reason to trust this account. And that's because no first century Jew inventing a story to try to convince people would have used female witnesses to anchor it. Now, today we would. But they wouldn't have back then because women were devalued in a way that's kind of hard for us to imagine in the 21st century. Rabbis actually debated whether or not to allow a woman's testimony in court. And so if Matthew was wanting to fabricate a story that was going to convince people, he would be using males. But he actually does the opposite. Matthew's making the men look bad, himself included. Like in Matthew's account, the men are hiding and fleeing, and it's the women who are acting with nobility. Why is Matthew telling the story this way? Because that's how it happened. If he was making up the story, he would probably made up a different story that would have seemed more appealing to his contemporaries. But Matthew's not trying to make up a story. Who is it that acted with nobility? It's the women. Who is it that God chose to be the first witnesses to the resurrection? It was the women. Matthew's telling it as it happened. And so these women, they saw the body. That they were witnesses, that Jesus truly died. He wasn't just unconscious on the cross. They saw him. In fact, and they weren't the only ones. The Romans and Jews also saw the body. In Mark's account of the same story, he tells us that Pilate was surprised when he heard that Jesus had already died. Sometimes crucifixion victims would linger for a couple days before they died. Jesus died the same day he was crucified. And Pilate summons the centurion and asks him, is Jesus already dead? And he learns from the centurion, yes, Jesus is already dead. And so then he lets Joseph have the corpse, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But Pilate gives a corpse over because it's been determined that Jesus is already dead. So his body was seen and his body was buried. So verse 57, when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. The same Marys who had been there at the cross, watched Jesus die. They're there at the tomb, seeing the body being put in, seeing the stone being rolled up. So the 11 disciples had fled, but there's actually another disciple here stepping up, Joseph of Arimathea. Mark's account tells us that he was a respected member of the council, the same council that put Jesus to death. Evidently, not all of them agreed. He's a respected member of the council who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God. Mark says he took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. So he wanted for Jesus a better burial than criminals typically received. And he's got a solution. His own tomb. It's the tomb of a rich man, which actually fulfills prophecy. Isaiah 53:9 prophesied this. It says, and they made his grave, the suffering servant, Jesus, they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death. Interesting. Fun little nerd out prophecy fulfillments. Expensive tombs were essentially caves that had to be hewn into the rock. They were going to be low caves that you have to stoop in to go into, and a large stone to be rolled down an incline to cover the entrance. And the stone, relatively speaking, was kind of easy to get in place, but to remove it, that was a different story. I was over having dinner or playing games with Craig, and yeah, we did have dinner with Craig and Michelle in their backyard, and they have built a small fountain in their backyard, and they were showing it to us, and there's some lower rocks, and then there was a larger rock put on top of it, and the larger rock had a hole drilled in it for the water to come out, and this rock was about 6 inches thick, about 2 feet by 3 feet, and you'd look at it, and it's like, oh, that's a good-sized rock, but you'd think it would be kind of liftable. And Craig was telling me how he couldn't believe how hard it was to lift this thing just 2 feet up. He said it took several men, and one of them was a bodybuilder. And so now imagine a stone 3 or 4 times that size. So that's the type of stone we're talking about. We'll come back to that in just a moment. So the body, it's placed in the tomb. A member of the Jewish council saw to it. And guess who else was there? Both Marys. They witnessed it, and as we'll see in a moment, soldiers also witnessed it. And so right now, Matthew is establishing something that really matters. Jesus really died. His body was seen, his body was buried, and this matters a whole lot, because if he didn't really die, then there's not a resurrection. And so we have to establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus was actually dead, and so that's what the text is doing. But before we look at the last aspect of Jesus really died, how his body was secured, first, I just want you to note the courage that's taken place here from these women who are willing to be present when the men had fled and from Joseph. So for him to go to Pilate, who had just had this man be crucified, and want to do something to honor this person who's maybe a threat to Caesar, both Joseph and these women, they've got the courage to be associated with a person who's on the wrong side of the narrative, so to speak. Who's got the wrong story. And this starts to clue us into something. If we're going to make his story our story, it may require the same kind of courage. The kind of courage that's willing to be associated with someone that the world has written off. So we've seen that Jesus' body was seen, his body was buried, and his body was secured. Verse 62, the next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise.' Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people, 'Oh, he's risen from the dead.' And this last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers." Basically saying, yes, okay, you can have a guard, take them, go make it as secure as you can. So they went and they made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Now note here, the Jewish leaders didn't think that Jesus was actually going to rise. They just wanted to stop that from becoming a false narrative. And they're like, this is going to be a fraud. There was already this fraud that he was the Messiah. That was bad enough. And now there could be another fraud that this Messiah rose from the dead. Let's just put a kibosh on this before anything can get out of hand. Maybe they're remembering what he told them in Matthew 12:20. He said, just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And they're like, we don't want any kind of, we've had enough dealing with this guy and with his people. And so they think they're protecting the people from deception. Well, Matthew's actually making the point, no, they're deceiving themselves. And so they this is interesting, they themselves are taking steps to make sure that the disciples can't steal away the body and hide it in order to claim that Jesus rose. The reason that's ironic is that's the very story they decided to invent themselves later on. But they're trying to make sure that can't happen and that there's no way that the disciples could have stolen the body. And so they receive permission to have a guard of soldiers remain with the body to keep it secure. A seal is put on the tomb. It wasn't the kind of seal that you couldn't get around. It's not going to prevent tampering, but it's the kind of seal that would show if tampering had occurred. It'd be obvious that the seal was broken, and it would also be stamped with an official insignia, letting people know that there'd be criminal consequences if the seal was broken. And so Jesus's body, it's behind a seal, and it's guarded by a squad of soldiers, and that's the way things remain for 3 days. And this is all showing us Jesus really died. Like, if you recall, Christ was whipped so severely, his bones were laid bare. He couldn't even carry the crossbeam. He was so weak. He's nailed to a cross. He's finally pierced with a spear. And there's no way that he survived that and then woke up in this dark tomb in a coma 3 days later all by himself and in this crucified state, threw off 75 pounds of grave clothes and rolled away this huge stone and defeated a squadron of Roman soldiers who were guarding his tomb. Like, Christ really died. And most have been willing to concede that, yes, he did. But some have said, well, his disciples only thought he rose because, you know, they went to the wrong tomb. They went to an empty tomb. The location of the tomb wasn't a mystery. Like, there's a seal on it, and there's a detachment of Roman soldiers guarding it. So Jesus really died. His body was seen, his body was buried, his body was secured. And with that established, now we can start looking at what makes this the story of stories, which is that Jesus really rose. Jesus really rose. And this is told through the lens of what these women saw. And they saw three things that just provide evidence and assurance that Jesus actually really rose, starting with the fact that they saw an angel. So chapter 28, verse 1 says, "Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it." Doesn't take four or five angels to move a stone. His appearance was like lightning, his clothing white as snow, and for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen as he said." God actually sends a heavenly messenger to make it unmistakably clear what has happened. Similarly to the way God, he works through humans to accomplish his purposes, he also works through angels to accomplish his purposes. And usually we can't see them, but they're on mission with God in a way similar to we are. The Bible tells us that they are spiritual messengers sent out to do his will. And in this story, because of the angel, the guards, they're temporarily paralyzed. Maybe they're in a coma, maybe they're comatose, we don't know exactly. And the angel, he didn't appear to let Jesus out. The angel actually appeared for the sake of the women, so that they can hear the message and so that they can enter the tomb themselves. And I just find this a little bit humorous. Like, these guards, the ones who are assigned to keep the dead dead, are like the dead now. Like, the ones assigned to keep the dead man in the tomb, they're the ones lying there like dead men, and the dead man is alive, and the living ones are flat on the ground. Oh my God, God, you're awesome. I know for some, it can be easy to read this story and think, well, yeah, I've never seen an angel. I don't believe in angels. And I would just say, obviously you can believe what you want, but there's either a supernatural realm or there's not. So if Jesus rose, as I'm contending, then there is a supernatural realm, which means there is a supernatural reality. And it can be easy to think, well, then why doesn't God prove it? You mean like come to earth and do miracles and rise from the dead and announce himself via angels? So he did that. Well, I don't know if I believe in that stuff. I just want to highlight the narrative that might be controlling a life. It's very hard to have a rational conversation with logic that says, if God is real, he would prove it supernaturally. But if he did and history documented it, I wouldn't believe it because God's not real and there's nothing supernatural. Like, so you can't make his story your story if you are pre-committed to an anti-supernatural narrative. If you are pre-committed to a different narrative, then the story of stories is not going to help you. Like, we have the story of stories in order for us to know, okay, what is true, so that we can align all our stories with the true stories. But if we reject the measuring line, then all we're left with is determining whatever story we want for ourselves. And most stories don't lead to flourishing. There's only one story that leads ultimately to life. And so the true story is telling us that Jesus really rose. And we know this because these women, they saw an angel who told them Jesus rose. We know that the women saw the place. So the angel's still talking here, and he says to the women, "Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead, and behold, he's going before you to Galilee, and there you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy, and ran to tell his disciples. So as if the angel's word wasn't enough, he invites them to come in to the tomb, examine it for themselves. So they were there when the body was placed in the tomb. They were there when the stone was put into place. Now they're present when the angel appears, when the stone is rolled away. So when they arrived, the tomb was still sealed. There were soldiers. When that tomb had been sealed, there was a body inside. And when that guard was placed, there was a body inside. But now, nobody. Like the stone is rolled away. You might think, well, Jesus would need that moment to make his way out of the tomb, and then they would see him exit. But no. No, he was actually already gone. He was resurrected into a spiritual body that's not bound by stone, not bound by sealed tombs. And it's one of those amazing moments. So I've seen people trying to imitate this. Maybe you've watched a magician and there's some box on the stage and he puts some lady in it and we don't know how she actually fits in that box. But then he runs a couple swords through it and he opens the box up and where'd she go? She's not there. And then all of a sudden the spotlight shines, 30 yards back, and there she is up on the balcony, waving to everyone. Like, how did that happen? That kind of moment's like, what? That can't happen. And of course we know, okay, somehow he tricked us, and we're kind of amazed because we don't know how he tricked us. We know he did because ladies don't get swords put through them and then disappear from there and appear over there. But in this case, we're looking at something that's not a trick. There's no magic trick going on. So that same sort of wonder that you might have watching a magic show, multiply that by however much infinity you want to. I guess there's not degrees of infinity, but whatever. Pick your number. And that's the kind of wonder that they're dealing with. Like they go into the tomb, so they watched it. They were there when it was sealed. The body was in there. The stone gets rolled away. It's a massive stone. It's so big. No one had been messing with this stone. And they go in and there's no bones. Which means this wasn't just a spiritual resurrection where Jesus' body stayed dead, but his spirit came alive. No, this was a physical resurrection. There's no part of Christ that was left in that tomb. There's only some grave clothes. They saw the place. They saw the place before the stone was rolled away. They saw the place right after the stone was rolled away. Jesus really rose. They saw an angel. They saw the place. And then they saw Jesus. Verse 9, and behold, Jesus met them and said, hello. Greetings. That's what that is. And they came up and they took hold of his feet and worshiped him. And Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go tell my brothers to go to Galilee. And there they will see me. And we'll look into that next week. But I can't imagine, I was thinking about this week. I can't imagine the emotional crash they eventually had. That's not recorded. So you put yourself in their shoes. They've gone through the agony of the cross, looking at him bloody, whipped, naked, hung up as a criminal, dying. They've gone through the silence of the tomb. They've gone through this confusion of the morning. And then their hearts are already heavy. And they show up and there's an earthquake and there's an angel. And they're terrified, but the angel's like, don't be afraid. And then he's given them this really good news. And so there's been all these emotions. And now, all of a sudden, there's Jesus. Like, I've had some emotional spikes in my life, a lot of them tied to the performance of my sports team, where all of a sudden I'm screaming out or I'm dropping to my knees, no! Thinking of the Super Bowl, why didn't they hand it off to Marshawn Lynch? Falling to my knees, or the Gonzaga Bulldogs a while back when Jalen Suggs hit that shot almost from half court and our whole family went off like, I heard a phrase, like Pentecostals on crack. I don't know if that's okay to say or not. But I also know in my life, when I have an emotional high a couple days later, or maybe the next day, or a couple hours later, I just crash. So I just trying to put myself into the shoes of these ladies and all the different emotions they are experiencing. But nothing I've ever experienced would be like this. Nothing I've ever experienced would match the agony of seeing someone tortured and whipped and watching it, nothing I can do about it, thinking they're dead forever. Some of you have processed grief of the loss of a loved one. You know what that's like. And then to all of a sudden see that person and it doesn't make any sense at all, but you also know it's real, and how do you respond? Well, they fall down and they actually grab his feet, physical feet, like prostrate before Jesus. We don't know exactly what they said or how they worshiped, but the text tells us that they were worshiping, and it's because the sun has come out. He's given beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, garments of praise for the spirit of heaviness. And now they become the first ones commissioned to share the exciting news. Go quickly, tell my brothers. We'll talk more about that kind of stuff next week. But for now, there's something actually I find rather remarkable about the words of Jesus. What's the first thing he says about those who denied him? He says, they're my brothers. Go and tell my brothers. Family. I got to imagine that when the disciples heard that he was alive, like, we just denied him, we just betrayed him, we just fled in every direction, and he's alive and he wants to meet with us. What do you say again, Mary? What's happening? He said you're his brothers. Wow. Family. Like, how are they not the outcast? Well, we saw last week, it's because Jesus became outcast in their place so that they wouldn't have to be. How are they not forsaken now? How is he not forsaken? They forsook him. How is he not forsaking them? Well, it's because Jesus was forsaken in that moment on the cross so that we would never have to be forsaken by God. Newsflash, Jesus is God. How are they not being judged? How can they be back on mission with him? Well, it's because he was judged for them so that they wouldn't have to be. How are they not condemned, found guilty? Well, it's because he was condemned and found guilty in their place. And you see what's happening here? The story of stories is being written. Do you see how Jesus is writing a new story over their life? We have these scripts, and some of them we know. Sometimes we don't know what the scripts are, but some of the scripts that we have inside say we're the abandoned one, we're the guilty one, we're the one that needs to that's being judged, we're the outcast. And I just want you to hear that there's a new story. We don't have to live from those inner scripts that bind us, keep us trapped. There's a story of stories. And when we surrender our story to his story begins to heal our story. His story begins to transform our story. His story actually begins to redeem our story. But so often there's these competing narratives that vie for attention. And that's actually what we see next in the text. So continuing on, verse 11, it says, while the women are going to tell the disciples what's up. It says, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we'll satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So they took the money, and they did as they were directed, and this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. So some of the soldiers go, and they report what they could. You know, it seems like they were out for some of it. But they know there was an earthquake, and they know that there was an angel, and they know that the stone got rolled away. And then after that, they were presumably comatose, so they likely didn't hear the angel, what the angel said about Christ. They likely did not see the risen Christ. But they know, so they share what they know, and they know they have a problem, because if it's determined that they slept on their watch, the penalties could be severe, perhaps even death. Like, think about their story. Oh yeah, you saw an angel. Oh, that's why you failed in your duty. An angel, really? That you're gonna go with that? You're gonna go with that? The angel? It's an angel thing? Well, interestingly, it seems that the Jewish leaders accept their testimony. And if you were to truly believe that an angel from heaven took out the guard that you placed and removed the stone that you sealed, you would think that your response would be something along the lines of, oops, maybe we're bought into the wrong narrative. Maybe it's time to course correct. But no, they pay large sums of money to create their preferred narrative. And the soldiers are bribed to lie. And so they stole him. That's the oldest alternate theory to the resurrection of Jesus. Although it's actually among the least plausible based on the evidence, so most people don't even try that story anymore. Because under close inspection, like, this attempt to suppress the truth collapses. Like, really? All the guards were asleep, knowing that there might be a plot to steal the body and that their penalty could be execution? And rolling this huge stone away that would require multiple men, it awakened none of them? And then wait a minute, if the guards actually slept, how do they know what happened? Last I checked, sleeping witnesses don't make very good witnesses. Which prompts one theologian to write, the excuse that they are to give is the very one which the guard was designed to prevent in the first place. It's actually significant that the Jews never tried to allege that the body was stolen before the guard arrived. They actually knew it wouldn't hold. I found this was interesting. I read this. It is significant that no early writer, Jew, Greek, or Roman, ever identifies a tomb in which Jesus' body remained. So all this, all their commitment to the narrative they preferred, it proves that their claim when Jesus on the cross is false. They were saying, hey, if you come down, just do something to prove, then we'll believe. Like, what's harder, to come down alive off the cross or to come up alive after the cross? He did the harder thing. See, the problem here is not lack of evidence. What we have here is a devious disinformation campaign designed to cover up the truth. And that is still a reaction that takes place today. Powerful people still aligned together. They use their money. They're committed to suppressing the truth. And actually, we should expect this. Expect it. Don't worry about it. They couldn't stop the truth back then. They're not going to be able to stop the truth now. The story of stories is going to prevail over any other competing story. Those people are dead and gone, and Jesus is alive and present. There's one narrative that continues to spread across the globe despite all opposition, and it's the narrative that's probably had more opposition than any other thing in human history, and it continues to spread, and that's because the master storyteller is telling his story, and he's executing his story, and his story is going to happen. He's written the beginning and the end. He's the Alpha and the Omega. Nothing's going to stop it. Which means being pre-committed to a different story is a problem. Being pre-committed to a non-Jesus narrative is never going to work out in the long run. And I think there's a number of ways that people can be pre-committed to a non-Jesus narrative, and some of it happens inside the church, some of it happens outside the church. For some people, a symptom of pre-commitment is this: well, I need a natural explanation. And if I can't get that kind of an explanation, then I won't respond to the story of stories. And so we see that there's another narrative that's ruling them. Whatever, it has to be natural. That's ruling their life, naturalism. So for some people, I choose the narrative that matches the impressive people. And in this story, the impressive Jewish leaders, they had the money, and they were telling the guards, like, hey, do this, and we'll work it out with the governor. And so people choose the narrative that matches the impressive people. And that would just be one symptom of a pre-commitment to a non-Jesus narrative. For some people, maybe in the church, if we're pre-committed to a narrative, it might be that we open the Bible and we're like, yeah, I can see what it says, but this part, I need to be able to explain it a different way. And when we start looking at what is it, what parts are we wanting to explain a different way, that can start to clue us in on what are the secret inner scripts that are actually running our life that might be in conflict with the story of stories. And those are the areas where we want to bring them to the story of stories and let the story of stories begin to heal our stories, transform our stories, redeem our stories. I think one thing from this text, so an angel appeared. There were miracles that happened. And in spite of that, people didn't believe. I think this should, sometimes we in the church can think, well, I need miracles. Or someone outside the church, like I would need a miracle. If there would just be a miracle, I would believe. In the church, we can think, if there was just miracles, if we just had more miracles, if we just had more God encounters, people would believe. Actually, the men in the story saw miracles and they encountered an angel and they didn't believe. Jesus did more miracles than anyone. They killed him. We need to make sure that our hope remains in the one who can change hearts and not in the miracles that he can do. I mean, I believe in miracles and I'd love to see God do miracles, and miracles are great. More of them, please. But make sure that's not the inner script that starts to replace the story of stories. So in this story, we're seeing this true story that Jesus really died. Jesus really rose. I'm going to read from a book. One paragraph tells a story. Years ago in England, this is a true story, right? But this is history. Two men set out to disprove Christianity. One was a well-known English jurist and literary scholar named Lord Lyttelton. The other was Gilbert West. And they agreed, if Christianity was to be discredited, two things were necessary: to disprove the resurrection and to explain the conversion of Saul of Tarsus in a way that satisfied the skeptics. The two men divided these tasks between themselves, Lyttelton taking the problem of Saul and West agreeing to research the resurrection. They invested over a year for their studies, then met together to compare notes, and each was astonished to discover that the other had become a Christian. The evidence was too strong, the truth undeniable, and it still is. So make his story your story. It's the true story. If Jesus rose from the dead, that means his suffering succeeded. It means that God accepted that he died in our place for our sins. That's something that we can trust. That's something that we can believe. And if you've never put your faith in Christ, that's where things start for you. That's where the transformation of your story begins. It's by believing his story. It's by accepting the story of stories. And if that's you today, I'd love to talk with you. You can either find me after the service. We'll have a prayer team after the service. We have people at the Welcome Center. You can use the QR code to let us know. Like, we'd just love to talk with you about this, about how this story of stories can transform your own story. The resurrection means that this story is true, that Jesus succeeded, that it really happened. And the resurrection means that we can have relationship with Jesus because he's not dead. He's not a pile of bones somewhere. He's actually alive, with us always, as we will see next week. And the resurrection means that we're going to be raised. And the resurrection means that there's power to live a new life. There's power for our broken stories to be healed and redeemed. Ephesians says, The immeasurable greatness of God's power toward us who believe is according to the working of his great might that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead. That kind of resurrection power is available to us, and we lean into it by leaning into his story, letting his story transform ours. In fact, this is one of the hinge points of the book of Romans. The Romans tells his story, the gospel, what Christ did for us. And then it says, in view of the mercies of God, in other words, leaning into that, let's be transformed by the renewing of our mind. What's that mean to be transformed by the renewing of your mind? It means we find these inner scripts that don't align with the true story. And we start taking those thoughts captive and declaring them as false and renouncing them and repenting for them, taking them captive to the obedience of Christ and then declaring what is true and letting the true story start to be the thing that fills our mind and then begins to transform us. So we're going to move into a ministry time now. I just want to ask the Lord to highlight what are some of the inner stories in our life that need transformation. So prayer team, if you wouldn't mind coming up. Music team, if you wouldn't mind coming up. For sermon recording purposes, keep this part in because this is we're still in sermon mode right now. Father God, could you help us right now to identify the inner stories in our life that you want to bring transformation to through your great story, through the story of stories. So I'm gonna share just briefly how this works out for me. So over time, I've learned to identify some inner scripts that try to run my life. One of them is the fear of rejection. And sometimes I'm blind to it, but it's very easy for that to color my interactions. And I've learned to recognize that and ask the question, Lord, is this operating in my life right now? God, I'm going to confess it. That's wrong. God, I'm sorry for that. I renounce that. I don't have to live as one rejected because Jesus took God's rejection at the cross so I would forever have acceptance from God. And then I have to start leaning into that. I have to start thinking about who am I? I'm the accepted one. I have the only acceptance that truly ultimately matters. And as I lean into that, this destructive script that wants to run my life starts to lose its power, and a healthy, productive script starts to take its place. I tend to think, okay, my acceptance is going to be based on my performance. I have to be inspiring enough or convincing enough or logical enough or persuasive enough. And if that starts to run my life, it leads to insecurity, it can lead to pride, and I have to stop and say, okay, what script is running my life right now? That's not the story of stories. That's not the deepest ancient magic. It is an old story. It's an old, old story. Hey, you can do it yourself. You can pull it off. You figure it out. It's a very American story. Pick yourself up by your bootstraps and perform, and you'll get your acceptance that way. But actually, I have to come and I have to dethrone that, I have to confess that. No, I'm going to take that thought obedient to the I'm taking it captive to the obedience of Christ because that's not the story of stories. The story of stories tells me that God came and he performed in the way that I couldn't. The story of stories tells me that my acceptance is based on his performance. And so then as I start to marinate on the true story and I connect the dots between that story and my story, it begins to heal my story. It begins to transform my story. This is one of the reasons that it's so important to us that we're motivated by the gospel here at Connection Point Church. It's not just that we say the gospel over and over, although we do that. What we're trying to do is connect the dots between the true story and our story in such a way that our story becomes more and more in alignment with the true story, and we get freed and healed and liberated from the false stories that we tell ourselves. So let's just close our eyes right now, and I'm just going to ask the Lord to help us. So Father God, would you bring to mind right now, what are the inner scripts that might be subconsciously running in the background of our hearts? Don't assume that the thought that comes to your mind right now is just you. For many of you, the Lord is going to bring to mind scripts that he wants to heal and redeem and transform. So let's listen. God is asking you to surrender that script to him, to raise the white flag. Hey, God, I surrender this narrative in my life that's been ruling me. I want to live from the story of stories. Would you help me to lean into your story? Would you show me how your story can heal and transform and redeem my story? Just talk to God. There is a track to run on. There is a track to live our life in accordance with, and it's the gospel. And I just had a book come to my mind right now. I feel like the Lord wants me to offer for you. It's called A Gospel Primer. And it's just someone's meditations on the gospel, but as you read through it, you'll realize, okay, he's actually connecting the gospel, the truth, the story of stories, to all these broken areas of life. Whether it's anger or performance or unforgiveness, lack of joy. And that book is an example of how do we lean into the story of stories in such a way that it's not ethereal pastor talk, but it actually begins to affect our own story. So it's called A Gospel Primer by a guy named Milton Vincent. I just would recommend that to you.